Hey everybody, welcome back for episode 4 of the Arctic Ice Hockey Podcast. He's Ben Wendorf with the Glow Sticks. I'm Trevor Mon with your illegal drugs, and we are here to rave it up this morning. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I got a little bit of a bum knee. I might have to go on a 15-day, but that's all right.
Well, as long as you can kind of do the old man dance where you're wagging a finger and stepping with the other foot and tapping the toe, then I think that that'll be just all right. We're going to start today's show, as we always do, talking a little bit on the Winnipeg Jets. Obviously, news on them has been a little few and far between since they did not make the NHL playoffs. But a couple weeks ago, Peter Adler of the Edmonton Journal blog came out with a report that Alexander Bemestrov, who is a star player for the Winnipeg Jets, had been offered a contract by the KHL's Akbars Kazan. That proved to be false. They were contacting the agent of Alexander Bemestrov, and he said that the claim had no factual evidence to it. But a few days later, Gary Lawless came out for the Winnipeg Free Press and wrote a column about how he believed that Alexander Bemestrov should be assigned to St. John's for the start of the 2012-2013 season. So Ben Wendorf, I ask you this, what are your thoughts on Alexander Bemestrov going and starting the year in the AHL?
Well, this is really a tough call. The timing is really bad because obviously his RFA status comes up after the following or next season. And so he's already got two full seasons in the NHL. Part of that is kind of something that got passed along to us because, of course, the Atlanta management made the decision to play him and burn a couple of years off his ELC. But, the idea of sending this guy down to the AHL at this point, I mean, do we think that we have somebody that's going to replace his minutes? I mean, he actually played a pretty substantial amount of minutes in the forward lines. He also killed penalties for us. I mean, he obviously exhibits talent that we were looking for, or that the Atlanta management was looking for, the first round pick. I mean, this guy is not a bad hockey player. So I think there should be some serious question over how this is really going to help his development and the team in general.
Well, and you raise a good point, as you normally do on these Saturday mornings. You seem to be the more coherent of the two of us. But I dug up some fantasy stats because normally this is something that's a little out of my realm, but I did want to kind of integrate it for the fans that like it. And I was looking at Bemestrov's stats, and my baseline was any Jets player that had played more than 20 games I considered in the numbers. Anybody that hadn't, because there was Spencer Mihacek that was on there, Carl Klingberg was on this list, Derek Mitch was on this list, all guys that I didn't feel offered enough substance to be in my critique. So we're talking about the Andrew Ladds, the Blake Wheelers, the Bogosians, because I limited it to forwards. But what I noticed was on the team for the Winnipeg Jets last year, Alexander Bemestrov ranked 5th overall with a Corsi rating of 7.9. His PDO also ranked 5th on the team, and he was 2nd on the team in penalties drawn. So although he only scored 28 points throughout the course of the season, he was doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes that doesn't show up on a score sheet. I mean, he was asked to play, like you said, a lot of penalty kill. He was asked to play a lot of garbage minutes. I mean, he was up and down between the second and the fourth line, sometimes getting in on the first line. Like, there was a lot of fluctuation this year for Alexander Bemestrov. And you look at a guy, if you want to use a comparable, you look at a guy like Blake Wheeler. He struggled a bit at the start of the year. They demoted him to the fourth line. But once he got going again, he was on that first line. It was Ladd, Little, Wheeler basically the whole way, barring injuries or a shuffle. Well, you had a guy like Bemestrov that was just plug and play. And that's tough for a guy because you don't have a rhythm. I mean, we're talking about rhythm. You and I have, we started this show about half an hour ago, and I keep missing up because I don't have a rhythm. So obviously rhythm is important, especially in hockey. So, I mean, there are some things that are there. And let's keep in mind, too, that Alexander Bemestrov has played 150 NHL games. Once he hits 160, he can't clear waivers anymore. He's not waiver exempt. So if they're going to do it, it's going to have to be to start the season. There's going to be no trial period. And like you said, do you have somebody in mind that you're going to bring in? I don't think there's anybody in the system right now that can match his skill set. And, I mean, are you going to go out and overpay for somebody on the market that you're hoping can be your Alexander Bemestrov? I mean, for me, it just doesn't make sense. But maybe you have more on that.
Yeah. the thing that you also have to realize with Remy Straub is that his ice time changed drastically over the course of the year. I mean, early on in the year, he was getting power play minutes. He was getting kill minutes all year. But basically, as the year wore on, Noel seemed to have less faith in him, was maybe concerned about whether he's getting fatigued and things like that. And so at our level, watching the games, of course, we were wondering, where the hell did Remy Straub go? I mean, the first half of the season, he seemed to be involved in a lot of the plays. He was getting points on the board and things like that. But what turns out, if you look at the time on ice data, is that his time decreased as the season went along. And so there's some question over how much he got worse or how much he got tired versus how much time he lost, you know?
Well, and Ben, do you think that might be more of a situational thing? Like, do you think that was because, I mean, they had him kind of going at center for a while, and then they realized that maybe he wasn't the center that they wanted him to be, so then they kind of axed his minutes because they felt if he was going to play the wing that there was other guys that could go out and do the job maybe a bit better than him this year, maybe try to insulate him a little more?
Maybe, but I mean, the logical choice, a logical replacement would have been Kyle Wellwood. In fact, really, I mean, I probably would have argued that Wellwood should have been the center all along with Remy Straub on a wing. But, you know, Wellwood didn't get a drastic increase in play at center. He did get a little bit more as the season progressed. And so I think there was concern over whether he was tailing off because he couldn't handle the full season. I think that there's still not a lot of faith on the part of the coaching staff on Remy Straub, even though we know that he has a talent. I mean, we know that he can do this stuff. And so I wish that there probably would have been as much faith put in his direction as we put in Evander Kane's direction, even though early on there was some spotty ice time figures there. By mid-season, he was rolling, you know, he was getting plenty of power play minutes, he was getting plenty of even strength minutes, and that went on till the end of the season. And of course, Kane turned into a 30-goal season. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility for Burmy next year.
Well, and another thing that we have to keep in mind is we're talking about two 20-year-old kids, and Truck, or Tim Bonner, as he's known to us, came out yesterday with kind of a data sheet of past and present Winnipeg Jets, excluding any Coyote stats, excluding any Thrasher stats. And Remy Straub was still in the upper echelon of the history of players that were 20 and under in terms of points. Now, like you said, he was a guy that they kind of took out of their power play. Why? I'm not entirely sure. I still think he played a good two-way game for them, as displayed by the evidence that he was playing the penalty kill. But I really think that your offensive numbers get really stifled when you are out there on the penalty kill and you're looked at to be a guy that goes out there and does the bulk of the heavy lifting, because it really takes away from your even strength time, it takes away from your power play time, and you're asked to play a different role. It gets you out of the mentality of, okay, we're going to get the puck, we're going to go, where it's more of a chip chase and change, right? So does that have a factor in it? Maybe. I mean, they are professional athletes at the end of the day, and there's a lot of guys that go out there and kill penalties and then still put up numbers. But I really do agree with you that they didn't really nurture him the same kind of way that they nurtured Evander Kane. And both have their off-ice issues, I guess you could say. Some say Remy Straub's has a bit of problem with authority, and he doesn't completely understand the language. So I found it kind of funny that, you know, there are such parallels between these two players, but yet they had a completely different path this season in terms of how they were utilized.
If we would have just said at the beginning of the year, okay, our top line is Ladd, Little Wheeler, our second line is Kane, Welly. We didn't know Welly was going to be as good as he was, but we had a sense that he was a solid player. You know, if we would have went with Kane, Welly, and Remy Straub and just locked it in place and gave them, you know, second forward line minutes and power play minutes as a second grouping on the power play. I mean, I think Remy Straub's numbers would have looked substantially better. And it just, it's interesting the difference between how they're dealing with Kane versus Remy Straub and so on.
Well, and you raise another kind of good point there that I kind of want to use with my tinfoil hat as I put it on my head now. You talked about a guy that's going to be a RFA at the end of next year. And what gets a player more money? Mm-hmm. Points. Right. Points, ice time, all that kind of stuff. So maybe you shelter him a little more. Maybe you're thinking a little outside the box here if you're Claude Noel. Maybe you're saying, okay, well, let's get this guy in. I mean, at 22, he's still going to be in the prime of his career. He's still going to be young and fresh. Maybe you're trying to grease the wheel a little bit, get a guy for a decent contract. And then, I mean, the Predators did it with Colin Wilson. He was set to score 20 goals this year. He was going to get a bonus. They sat him the rest of the year. They said, well, we don't want to pay you your bonus. He had a great year, kid, but go sit. So, I mean, there is precedent for it. Maybe they're starting to use that. I mean, at the end of the day, though, if Burmistrov is a good two-way player, I think that you've done your job in developing him. I mean, being a two-way guy on those top two lines is very important. You look at a team like the Washington Capitals, who are finally starting to buy into Hunter hockey. For the longest time, it was, okay, go let the wild horses run and whatever happens, happens. And those top two lines were getting torched. I mean, they had good Fenwick and they had good Corsi. But, I mean, the plus-minus, getting scored on when they were on the ice, I mean, it was, they were trading shots every time. And you need guys that can go out there and play those minutes for you and keep the puck out of your net as much as you need them to score. So, do you see him being in the AHL next year? Because I sure don't.
I don't see the justification for it. I mean, the sending down to the AHL is such... It's a big move for any player to have to get bucked down there. It's obviously a very powerful message to send to them. And but at the same time, I think it's a possibility just because of the fact that Noel could cramp down his minutes a bit, you know, kind of reduce his ice time. I mean, that doesn't just come out of Noel's butt. I mean, he probably had some support in the management group as well. So, you know, I guess it's not out of the realm of possibility that they might give up on this guy in the third year, especially if he starts slow. But it would be an incredible shame because he's obviously immensely talented. He obviously, like you said, he's already demonstrated that he plays a two-way game well, and that underrated part of his game that you mentioned, which is excellent, is those penalties drawn. That's actually a talent that he's demonstrated over the last 2 years. It's not just a fluky number for him. It's really hard to appreciate this drawing penalties thing. I mean, a lot of people kind of get caught up with kind of the fantasy hockey mentality of taking penalties somehow is indicative of a good physical player, but really the drawing penalties part is incredibly important. And the fact that, you know, a guy like Burmistrov is obviously stick handling with the puck, controlling the puck enough that people are going to try to disrupt him and get penalties in the process is an asset for the team.
Well, I guess that's all the Burmistrov talk that we can handle right now. Thank you very much for analyzing that with us, Ben. Ben is obviously well more adept at all these fancy stats than I am. So I guess when I dole them out, it's going to be a rare occasion. But I did think it was apt to bring into the fact that there's more than meets the eye with a guy like Alexander Burmistrov. We're going to move forward to an issue that's a little more recent in nature, and that is Ticketgate. And what Ticketgate is that it's been reported by the Federal Tax Commission that the Winnipeg Jets had been giving away free tickets to officials, government officials, as well as members of the MLCC and MPI. Now, Ben, obviously this is something that isn't, an isolated event. It happens across sport. What are your thoughts on it? What do you think of this ticket gate? And is it really not as big as a deal as some people are making it out to be?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you have to realize is that every sports team has to pander to this kind of upper crust, people who are potentially going to be involved in helping with funding for things like an arena, maybe, you know, or, you know, in general, kind of public support. One of the things that with these teams is that they're always aware of potential financiers or people that will help support the team within the city itself. So, you know, with Winnipeg being really at best kind of a mid-level market in the NHL, they need that kind of support. So it sucks on the one hand being a fan that's not privy to those kinds of privileges, but at the same time, it's a process that every team does. I mean, they'd give out tickets everywhere. It's just that this is a little bit ridiculous in regards to just how much it was, how hot those tickets were, and you know, the fact that it went to government officials.
Well, and for those of you who don't know, I didn't really intro it as well as I probably could have. We're talking about a minute amount of tickets. Most of these officials and members of the MLCC and MPI were taking one, maybe two tickets. Minto Manitoba MLA Andrew Shaw was the leading getter of tickets. I guess you could say he ended up with eight throughout the course of the year. But I mean, it is what it is. You have to get in bed with politicians every once in a while. And I mean, at the end of the day, the only people that are losing money on this are the Winnipeg Jets. I mean, in a dollars and cents. I mean, obviously they're gaining something more valuable behind the scenes. But in terms of ticket revenue, sales and all that, they're the only ones losing. And I mean, I guess some fans are losing on the experience, but I mean, we're talking probably about the more expensive tickets in the house. We're not talking about, you know, Nosebleed Joe or what have you. I mean, we're talking probably box seats. We're talking about the lower level seats that go for $130. So I mean, it is what it is. Is it news? Yes, it is. And we do have to cover it. It is very important because it's happening. And Greg Selinger, who is the premier of Manitoba, has come out and said that he's going to put a stop to it. It's gonna be a one and done, and you won't see it happening anymore. The issue is more so of the cooking of books and the backdoor shenanigans that may be going on with this. Obviously, there's going to be some tax write-off there, and that's the issue at hand that I'm more concerned with. I'm not so much concerned with the fact that these tickets were given out, but maybe the way that they're showing on these books. But obviously, some people are going to be upset. That's just the way things go in life. There's always two sides to everything. But I mean, like you said, it's not as big of a deal. And I mean, it happens in all sports. I'm sure that you see it very frequently with the Milwaukee Brewers, that they kind of pander to that. I mean, they just had a new stadium built. That doesn't just happen. Obviously, you have to get into bed with the devil every once in a while and make that work. So obviously,
yeah, I mean, there's it's a little bit different with the U.S. versus Canada kind of thing. I mean, the favoritism definitely goes towards potential private donors around here. It's more kind of the big business people get all the boxes. But I mean, I'm sure it happens in Canada too, but it's much more prominent here.
Well, and what you're saying there kind of brings me to something else that I find kind of funny about this whole situation. When the Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, was coming to games, they only had a certain select amount of tickets for him. And it's funny to know that they had so many free tickets set aside for members of our parliament here and for members of some of our upper echelons. The only thing that really bothers me is the kind of sweep it under the rug that's going on. Tom Broadbeck of the Winnipeg Sun had come out and kind of done what he always does, and it's kind of like a troll piece on the whole situation. And he was told that these tickets were given away because they didn't think that they would meet the 13,000 person requirement for season tickets, which is a farce. I mean, obviously this was cooked up long after that, and anybody who didn't think that those tickets would go was obviously very, very ignorant to the fact that this city is very passionate about its hockey. Obviously, this is more of just a one-and-done story. I'm not a politician. Ben's not a politician. There is obviously more going on, but that's all that we have right now. If you want a little more information, there's a good follow out there on Twitter. You can follow Darren Bauming. That's at DarrenBauming. And he was there at the legislative yesterday, and he followed the whole proceedings, Mr. Selinger's remarks, and he got a list, which we posted on the site, of all the MLAs who took free tickets. But having said that, we are going to move forward. We're going to talk about some more NHL stuff, and then we're going to close out with some NHL playoffs. Again, you're listening to the Arctic Ice Hockey Podcast, brought to you by Podomatic, who is now trying to bleed my pockets dry, but we'll save that for another conversation. What we wanted to talk about, we actually do have a new writer for us who's come on board. We're very happy to have him. Goes by the handle of Dan L 1988. And over the last little bit, he's done a lot of interesting work on a new supplemental discipline proposal. And I mean, it's very well thought out. It's very, very lengthy. And we just kind of want to get into the nuts and bolts of it without getting too deep. If you want to read it, go check out his fan shots on the site. That's arcticicehockey.com. And what Dan is proposing is a new kind of suspension system, which would be a first-time offender gets 3 games. A second-time offender or an offense that is graver than a first-level suspension would get 7 games. And a third-level offense or something very, very egregious, probably similar to the hit that Rafi Torres gave to Marian Hossa, would get 13 games. And then anything over and above would be dealt with on a later time and would have a very severe penalty. He also kind of talks about teams getting fined a little more so that maybe it discriminates them from dressing a guy like Matt Cook, a guy like Rafi Torres and whatnot. But Ben, I just want to get your thoughts. What do you think of this new proposal that Dan is kind of doling out there? And do you think that the NHL should adopt it or maybe a hybrid of it? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, one of the main purposes that Dan has with his proposal is trying to standardize. It's trying to set this into kind of a writ that could be followed, rather than what feels like this very arbitrary process where there's so many different factors considered. I mean, there's a general sentiment that players that are more important to their team are getting lesser penalties, in some cases no penalties, versus players that are bit part players. And so there's this kind of general concern at the arbitrariness of this whole thing. And so to standardize it is with the hopes then that it'll deter these kinds of activities. And the other thing that Dan's really getting at is making teams culpable in this process, because the emphasis always seems to be on the player and what they did. But especially in the case of repeat offenders, teams know these players are prone to doing these particular things. So hopefully there's also a little bit of culpability on the teams that decide to continue to employ these players out there. Maybe they'll think twice if they know that they're only going to get 50 games out of this particular player, and maybe that'll affect an attitudinal shift in the player themselves.
Right. And I mean, I do believe that you have to start reprimanding the team for dressing guys that go out there to hurt, you know, hit them in the wallet, hit them where it hurts. I do think that the actual proposal, while it's good, and I like the fact that there's actually some cohesion to it, I do think that, and I know this is going to sound like double speak because I want one thing, but I want it to get beefed up and I want it to get more serious. But at the same time, I think that you still have to treat certain incidents with a different scope than you would others. I mean, if it's a headshot, sure, mandatory 3 games, I'll give you that. If it's a hit from behind where a player turns, there's no injury, player gets up, but it's still a board, it's still a dangerous play, I don't think that you get 3 games. I mean, I still think that you have to be a little lighter on first-time offenders. I think 2 would be good. I still think 7 would be too high. I'd probably bump that to 5. And they have to get serious on what's going on with the player fining, because obviously $2,500 is absolutely nothing. And it's kind of a joke that they even fine players for that amount of money. I mean, you look at the NFL and their fining system is much more punitive. And I think that's something that the NHL should really think about adopting. Now, the other thing that really needs to be said about anything getting more serious in terms of suspensions is that Brendan Shanahan is going to need some help on his board. Obviously, he consults Colin Campbell. Obviously, he consults with Rob Blake about any of the decisions that he makes. But you want to talk about my doublespeak. You look at the NHL GMs and the NHL owners who were all on board with change, and then you go to the Board of Governors meeting in October, and Shanahan just gets absolutely blasted. And he's torn apart because, you know, he gives Wisniewski 8 regular season games for his gesture on I believe it was on Cal Clutterbuck. And then you handcuff the guy and you say, well, you know, we want to change it, but we don't want to change it like that. I mean, and it got back and it reverted to what it was last year. And there's more transparency, but it's still as crazy as it was last year. Stuff is getting called while other stuff isn't getting called. If you're a star player, normally you're above the line and you don't get any penalty at all, unless your name is Alexander Ovechkin and now more recently Claude Giroux. And I mean, it's kind of one of those situations that it's going to take something to get serious about, but it's got to come from management, and they all have to be on board. The last thing I'm going to say about it is, at the end of the day, the player still needs to have the right to an appeal. And that appeal has to come to an actual independent appeals court. It can't go to Gary Bettman, who employs Brendan Shanahan, who says, okay, well, I stick with what that guy said. You're suspended. Sorry, Rafi Torres, you got your 25 games. They need somebody that can come in and look at it with a lens that's not tilted in a certain way or tinted in a certain color and say, okay, well, this was fair. Sorry, it's going to be upheld, or no, this wasn't fair. And I mean, that's a real bargaining chip that they really have to come out with in the next CBA, because right now it's kind of unfair to some of these players that are just getting thrown under the bus, while others get off scot-free. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that that you want to share with us, Ben.
Yeah, the thing is that this whole concept of supplementary discipline is caught between a rock and a hard place, because on the one hand, the owners don't like the idea of having players that they paid for being out for 25 games due to a single infraction. And so, but at the same time, when they're frustrated by that thing, then they're forgetting the fact that in the long run, we're concerned about player safety, making sure that their assets aren't getting hurt by these same plays. And so there's some shifting that needs to go on there for them to realize that one's more important than the other. And the same thing with the Players Association. They're also caught between this this debate over whether those kinds of fines that players like Torres experienced are too draconian versus, once again, the player safety issue. And I think the Players Association is a little bit leans a bit more towards this player safety issue than do the owners. Mm-hmm. But really both of them need to keep that in mind, that the player safety is more important than concerns about the draconian suspensions, because you know there needs to be some kind of punishment for these actions that actually deters people from doing them.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, just to go back on what you said, you look at Mario Lemieux, great example. When the New York Islanders go out there and punk the Pittsburgh Penguins, and you got Trevor Gillies running around, and you got guys that are just out there to fight, and he comes out and says, this is a joke, I don't know if I want to own a team, etc., etc. And then this offseason, when he has Aaron Asham going out there clubbing Braden Schenn in the face with a stick, and then you had James Neal flying around there trying to headhunt, and he says nothing. Well, you can't be one way and not the other way. I mean, if you're going to come out and say something and have the balls to stand by something, it has to be the same when it's against you. And it's an absolute joke that some of these ownership groups and some of these GMs are all fine and dandy when it's not their player, but that as soon as that the knife is turned on their own, then they get all defensive and, well, this isn't fair, and so forth. So I do think that you should go out and you should read Dan's idea for supplemental discipline. He does go into some more of the finer details. It's a three-part piece. As I said, you can find it on Arctic Ice Hockey. And we're about to hit the half-hour mark, and this is actually fun because we really cut back on some of our topics this week, and it looks like we're going to finish in a good time constraint. So moving forward, we just want to talk about the sole NHL hockey game that's going on tonight. New York Rangers are hosting the Washington Capitals in Game 7 at the MSG tonight. And Ben, I want to know, before I delve into this, what your thoughts are and what your prediction is on tonight's game.
Well, the Washington Capitals and the Rangers, I didn't really expect this to go to 7 games. I mean, if I remember right, my prediction was the Rangers in 6. What's impressive to me is that Ovechkin continues to step up and play some pretty solid hockey despite all the things that swirl around him. I mean, there's been these cuts that he doesn't show up during the playoffs, which is not true at all, because he's actually an incredibly good player in the playoffs.
Yeah, I believe he's top 5 in NHL history in points per game, but right. Continue.
And so I mean that really in this playoffs we really started to see once again that Ovechkin is still a world-class player. But to more of a side point, though, is that we have this kid, Braden Holtby, who's holding back the tide. I mean, the New York Rangers are pouring shots on net. the Hunter philosophy is still there, that we're going to allow just a shit ton of shots, and let's hope that in the end we come out smelling like a rose. But the fact of the matter is that I'm still gonna lean towards the odds, and the odds are still in favor of teams that generate more shots. So I'm gonna pick the Rangers for Game 7. But the fact of the matter is that it's one game. Anything can happen. It's the beauty of the playoffs. In some cases, it's the thing that sucks about the playoffs, especially in regards to predictions. But honestly, I want the Capitals to win, because I like the idea of teams that have not won Stanley Cups in their history getting a shot at the title.
Well, I'm going to ask you now, what's your prediction for a final score?
Honestly, it's a tough call, but my guess is, just because we're about due for a game like this. We've had so many 2-1s, 1-0s, 3-2s in the playoffs. You know, maybe this is finally a game where things just break out. There's loads of offensive talent on both teams. So what the hell? 5-2, Rangers.
This hurts me. This hurts me very badly. Because I have a sneaking suspicion that you're right. And, and you know, it's the cross the Caps fans bear. And I make no bones about it. I am a Caps fan, and you all know that. And it just seems to be, you know, the history effect of it. And they always find a way in the biggest game not to live up to the hype, not to live up to the intensity of their opponents. And, I mean, this to me feels a lot like Pittsburgh in 2009 when they just got trounced, and it was 4-0 2 minutes into the second period. And you know what, Ben, if they're going to lose, I'd prefer they lose that way, just because, what was it now? Wednesday night or Thursday night? Mm-hmm. Wednesday night they played. That third period took at least 3 years off my life.
Yeah.
Because I was just white knuckling, and I was like, oh my goodness. Like, if one goes in, then the gates really open. Things in Washington's favor, obviously, from a more superstitious point, Braden Holtby is now the father of a young boy. His fiance gave birth, I believe it was Thursday, and that's always good luck. Babies always bring good luck, so I have that going for me. But it's really going to come down to me, the matchup between Richards and Ovechkin, and who gets the edge in that matchup. And one of these two guys is going to step up, and whichever one does is going to lead his team to victory.
I got a little question for you, actually.
Okay.
Just out of curiosity. So you're talking about Braden Holtby, and obviously he's had a hell of a playoffs, but. Right. Do you think that this gives him the edge in being the guy next year?
Yes. Yes, I do. Because just the demeanor. And you look at a guy, a lot of people say that he plays a lot like Carey Price. And I mean, I'd say maybe in the neighborhood of Carey Price. Okay, sure. I can see that. I mean, he still has room to grow and build, and maybe he can be there one day. But he has the demeanor of Mika Kiprusov, whereas he can let in a goal, and 5 seconds later, it doesn't faze him anymore. And that used to be his knock. It used to be that, you know, when he got unraveled, it was game over. And he'd let everything bother him. A guy would come through his crease and he'd be chopping him. He'd let in a goal and he'd freak out. And now he's got these weird idiosyncrasies that he now uses as ways to calm himself. And he's proven time and time again this playoffs. I mean, you look at him, he hasn't lost back-to-back games at all this playoffs. He's been pristine in those games. His save percentage is over .94. I mean, it's not like he's going up against stiff competition here. I solely believe that Vokoun is done in Washington now. And if it's between him and Neuver, it's going to be a 1A, 1B tandem. But in the playoffs, you're going to go with the guy that at least proved to you once that he can do it. And right now, that's Holtby. Would somebody else maybe come in and usurp? Maybe. But right now, he's the guy that you have to use going forward, I'd say.
Sure. And does Neuver become a potential trade chip? You know, does he... where does that place him then?
Well, you know what? That's a great question too. I really think that after they traded Varlamov, they made the decision and they said, we have three good young goalies. We know what we can get for one. I mean, I'm sure that they had Varlamov and Neuwirth neck and neck for trade bait, and then Greg Sherman forgot to take his crazy pills and said, here's a first and second for Varley, and they said, okay, see ya. But I really think that they're going to go with a 1A, 1B tandem of young guys. I mean, it seems more and more like that's where teams are starting to shift their focus. You need fresh legs. You need, you know, a guy that can come off the bench and win you some games. And there's not a lot of elder statesmen in the NHL these days that are in net that serve as a backup role. I mean, you have Brent Johnson. You have a guy like maybe DiPietro, but I can't really even count him in there because he's always hurt. You got Chris Mason, but for the most part, it's younger guys. You don't have that veteran backup goalie, so I really think that they'll go forward with the two kids and they'll play them against each other and see which one they're more confident with. But I mean, the real question to me is where Dale Hunter ends up next year. Obviously, the current head coach of the Washington Capitals. His London Knights actually won the OHL championship last night over the Niagara Ice Dogs. Shock of all shocks to me, because I thought Niagara was going to be the team to beat. They dispensed them in five games. Last night they won 2-1. And there's that sneaking suspicion that at the end of the year, maybe he goes back. If they get out of this round and into the conference championships, I think that that's going to be enough for him to maybe want to come back if he doesn't win the cup this year. If they lose this game 7, I think that that might be the end of Dale Hunter. As much as George McPhee wants to have him back and is going to try to have him back, I think that that'll be the end of it. So we're going to go forward now. We're just closing up shop for today, and we have another game 7 coming up of the AHL variety. This time it is the Wilkes-Barre Scranton Penguins and the St. John's Ice Caps. They played in game 6 last night and Wilkes-Barre won, I believe it was 2-1, so we have a game 7 upcoming between the two teams. Ben, who do you got?
I'm rooting for the Ice Caps just because I love the idea of these Jets prospects playing well, getting experience at a time when it counts the most. It's funny though, because you know Derek Meach is a guy who seems to be taking it running with it, and he's not really a true prospect,
right,
per se. But at the same time, I just, you know, the more experience for these guys, even at the AHL level, the better. Especially, you know, the fact that Scheifele's up playing with them now, and so, you know, any time that these guys can get with talent above the CHL level talent, the better.
I'm going to go against you here. I'm going to say that Wilkes-Barre wins. And,
come on.
Not that I want it to happen, but I just think that it's going to happen. I mean, they've been playing very, very strong hockey lately, and it looks like, I mean, the real capper for it for me, that kind of told me, oh, this team's in trouble, is last night Jason King got in a fight with one of the Penguins forwards with no time left on the clock, and that move just reeks of desperation, trying to swing some momentum back. Obviously, playing on home ice is going to be an advantage to them, but Wilkes-Barre has a lot of guys that have been there before, done it before, seen it before, and I really think that the guys over at Pensburg might be at least half right in their prediction. They said 6 games, but I think that Wilkes-Barre will win it in 7. That about wraps up our show today. We're about at the 40-minute mark, which is just fine by us. He's Ben Wendorf. I'm Trevor Mon. This is episode 4 of the Arctic Ice Hockey Podcast, and we're out.